ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, it's Hamish. Welcome to season two of Take Me to Your Leader. We've got some incredible people lined up for season two, from young leaders blasting their way onto the political scene, octogenarian leaders who've been around for decades, leaders of dynasties, democrats, demagogues, sometimes all of the above, even a king who seems to like wearing crop tops. But more about that later in the season. Of all the leaders that we've profiled on this series so far, no one has captured the world's attention and admiration quite like this one, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. When Russia launched into its war on Ukraine in February 2022, the comedian turned actor turned wartime leader became the face of Ukraine's resistance. He refused an offer of evacuation, famously telling Joe Biden that he needed ammunition, not a ride out of there. As the Russian bombs rained down, Zelensky went out into the streets of Kyiv. He used social media, talked directly to his people and to the world. Never have we seen a leader recording selfies from a city under attack quite like this. And just as Winston Churchill refused to bend to the Nazis, Zelensky will not roll over to Vladimir Putin, it seems. The man who played a president on television is in the role of his life. I'm Hamish McDonald. This is Take Me to Your Leader.
Yes, my name is David Dodson, and I'm a filmmaker, director, and editor, and originally from Dallas, Texas, and then recently spent 15 years working in both Russia and Ukraine making films.
You're mates with Volodymyr Zelensky. What's your nickname for him?
Well, I just call him Vova, which is a typical diminutive for Volodymyr.
I'm Olga Boychak. I am a lecturer in digital cultures at the University of Sydney.
And you're Ukrainian?
Yes. I was born and raised in Ternopil in Western Ukraine.
Also with me on this episode is Oleh Rybachuk. He's a political stalwart in Ukraine. He's done just about everything. And he's on a somewhat scratchier line from Kyiv.
Well, I'm a long time in politics. Know very well how a Ukrainian political kitchen works.
And you've survived all of that.
Yeah, I did. I am right now in Kyiv.
From the north to the south, Ukraine is under attack. Explosions were heard across the country before sunrise. This photo from the Ukrainian president's office showing an explosion in the capital.
I want to go back to February 24, 2022, the day that Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine. Oleh, Putin launches the war, and the broad assumption is that Kyiv will fall within days. What happened?
I was watching this via CNN and American media, and every time they started news, they've been saying, oh, Kyiv might be taking over next day. Then they've been surprised. It was extremely impressive and also depressive for me because my family was here. So I could feel how the world was expecting Kyiv to fall in these 3 days. And there were world famous experts, generals, ex-commanders of NATO saying that maybe 3-4 days. And only after 4th or 5th day, I noticed that rhetoric changed. But for me, it was absolutely terrifying, because I couldn't help my family. I was calling them daily, but I was looking at that war like ordinary American, I would say.
Did your family also think that Kyiv would fall quickly, that this would be a pretty easy job for the Russian army?
It's almost impossible to say whether people believed or not. They've been thinking about basic things, how to live through another day or night, because, well, Kyiv was under massive missile attack.
Yes, it was extremely chaotic. And I think what was one of the key things that happened at that time is because of the blackouts and because the internet connection sometimes was spotty, there was a large proliferation of disinformation. And one of the key messages that people got on their telegrams is that Zelensky and his family and the key Ukraine's government leadership had left the country. And I guess plausible at the time, right? You wouldn't know what was happening if you didn't have power, didn't have electricity, didn't have internet connection. So that first vlog that Volodymyr Zelensky recorded in the government quarters with his team, seeing very well which location he's in, it was quite an extraordinary event that did set the course for the rest of the war.
I would say that it was very encouraging that leadership didn't leave Kyiv, that Zelensky stayed. That was probably the best thing he did in his life.
We now know actually more of the details of what happened in those hours and days. Within minutes of Russia launching its attack, Zelensky woke his two children up and they did prepare to flee. He was public enemy number one, really, for the Russians. They came within minutes, it's said, of finding him and his family. And in fact, Russian troops made two attempts to storm the presidential compound. And they came so close that gunfire could be heard within the office walls. There was also a bunker outside of the Capitol that was waiting ready for Zelensky and his team. But again, he refused to go there. Instead of that, he just walked outside and filmed this video message on his phone.
Good morning to all Ukrainians. Here's the situation. I'm still here. We will protect our country. That's what I wanted to tell you. Glory to Ukraine. Slava Ukraine.
David, you were watching this unfold, I think, from Los Angeles. Famously, when Joe Biden, the US president, offered Zelensky a ride out of Kyiv, he answered in a way that I think shocked many, maybe even Biden. Were you surprised that he turned down the lift out?
No, I wasn't surprised at all. You know, for me, of course, it's very personal in the sense that my wife is Ukrainian. I met her in 2010 in Kyiv when I was editing a Zelensky movie. Her family, my in-laws now, are spread across the entire country, Cherkasy, Kyiv, Rivne, Lutsk. This war is a very, very personal thing. And on that first night, it was early evening in Los Angeles, and we got a single text message from my wife's sister in Lutsk that simply said bomb, because they live very close to an airfield, which was one of the targets on that first night. And so when Volva on that first or second evening, whenever it was that he came out and said these, you know, now iconic words, it didn't surprise me because none of our friends or family were interested in leaving either. So it seemed to me to be extraordinarily Ukrainian at heart. That is, that they were always going to be putting together groups of civilians, building Molotov cocktails in the alleys and waiting to do whatever they could if Russian tanks, you know, rolled down the Khreshchatyk. Maybe it was so shocking to the rest of the world because we have seen a relative paucity of that kind of courage or in diplomatic life these days. So it was impressive, but not altogether surprising.
Olga, you've got grandparents and other family there in Ukraine. What did it mean to you hearing those words?
Well, it was a testament of Ukraine's resilience and resistance. But it wasn't surprising in a way that there has been so much resistance to Russia's occupation over the first 8 years of Russia's war against Ukraine. And as someone who's been studying these networks of volunteers, really amazing forms of civil society that I've witnessed in Ukraine over the past years, we saw that they matter. And they matter even in a situation like that with a full-scale invasion.
What is important to know that the place which is called President's Office, where Zelensky was, is extremely secure. Previously built by Soviet Union under Stalin, there is like underground tunnels there prepared to withhold even nuclear strikes. And it's not five-star hotel, but it's extremely secure. So it's important to realize, and obviously he knew it, there is even connections to underground system of subways, secret tunnels, storage of food. All that was since World War II, since Cold War. But I also know that Russian special forces, they really had a heavy fight. And lots of bodyguards of Zelensky on that bunker was in that office. They practically all have been killed. Commandos tried and they did attack President's office, but they couldn't succeed.
Ole, do you think the Russians would have killed him if they'd found him?
Oh, they tried.
I do think it's worth winding the clock back a little here. Zelensky was born to Jewish parents in 1978, and he grew up as a native Russian speaker in an industrial city in southern Ukraine. His father was a computer scientist and his mother was an engineer, and his upbringing was relatively comfortable. He liked English rock music. He played the guitar. Ole, it's a detail that I find surprises people when I tell them that Zelensky is not actually a native Ukrainian speaker, that it was only when he decided to run for the presidency that he properly took it up and tried to learn to speak Ukrainian. In fact, he'd struggled with Ukrainian language in the past.
Right, you are. As previous Ukrainian presidents, some of them learned Ukrainian only when they became head of state.
Olga, I'm just interested in this language question because it seems to me to speak a little bit to the identity, the Ukrainian identity question as well. And obviously he's fought so loudly and proudly for the Ukrainian identity. For those not familiar with the layout and the dynamic, how does it work? Why does someone like him grow up not speaking Ukrainian and then go on to fight Russia to protect that national identity?
Yeah, that's a great question. In terms of Ukrainian identity, Zelensky is in a way a phenomenon because he does represent that everyday Ukrainian. And he does through his heritage, through the way that he manifests his own identity, he is a great symbolic representation, I guess, of contemporary Ukraine. It's too easy to kind of fall into those binary distinctions and see Ukraine as somehow divided. And somehow that's been the dominant understanding of Ukraine, especially here in the West. In fact, Ukraine has a large middle ground, and it's not black or white. It's not you're either being a Ukrainian speaker or a Russian speaker. So there are some people who have some ethnic Russians in their family. There are some people who speak a mixture of language. There is, in fact, a mixture of Ukrainian and Russian that's called Surzhik, on which a lot of people in the country talk in their daily lives. So Zelensky, in a way, was the epitome of that hybridity, I guess, cultural hybridity, ethnic hybridity. And then the identity that he represents is really a civic liberal identity of a civic liberal nation state. It is not an ethno-nationalist identity in any way.
What do you mean by civil liberal state versus ethno-nationalist?
Right. So when we think of a national identity and when we think of nationalism, who gets to be a Ukrainian, right? Who gets to be a Ukrainian citizen? Is it people who are ethnically Ukrainian? Is it people who speak Ukrainian on the daily basis, right? Or is it people who are the citizens of the Ukrainian state? And that is what makes them part of the polity. That would include Crimean Tatars, who are also members of the polity. That would include other ethnic minorities.
So this goes to the question of the Donbass region, which the war started around and Russia trying to claim it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is one thing that I guess Russia is playing on, but it's also not, it's misunderstanding it. And unfortunately, due to the narratives that are perpetuated by the Russian Federation, Ukraine is often understood in that nationalist sense, but it's a political nationalism. It is not an ethnic nationalism.
It's important to underline that practically Zelensky was, if not for that war, Zelensky as politician was already on very soft decline. His support was falling sharply. He has no competence in running the country. He never worked in any government offices. He is one of the best producers and businessmen in the territory of the Soviet Union. He was very successful in making movies, in making shows. And as any talented artist, he fills people's mood very well. So probably at some point, his artistic background helped him to feel what people would like to see. And now it became part of, he was playing role of the president, but then he very naturally became like concentrated expression of Ukrainian people.
I think that that's an extraordinarily important point. You know, he, as an entertainer, over the course of two decades, had a very powerful connection with audiences. He was a giant star in Russia. We made almost all the movies that I made with him, both the ones that I directed and the ones that I edited, they made most of their money in Russia. That was the biggest market, yeah. Of course. And he knows all of these people, but all the propagandists, all the people who now shriek about wanting him dead and how he's a Satanist and a pedophile and every other Russian propagandist lie, he knows them personally. And his sensitivity and his skill at communication and at reaching people directly It's almost unprecedented in politics in recent memory. His domestic policies and his domestic presidency prior to the war was not something that was getting much support. He seems to have been exactly the right man for this particular moment in time.
When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, Zelensky saw his chance to do what he loved, perform. At 17, he was part of a comedy team. And much to his parents' relief, he went to law school, where he did actually meet his future wife, Elena. But the stage lights beckoned. And so with his wife and friends, he created a successful comedy troupe and a production company called Kvartal 95, named after the district where he grew up in southern Ukraine. David, when did you first meet Zelensky and how?
I first met Vova in 2008 in New York City. He was shooting his very first feature film that was being directed by a Russian national, and I was editing that movie. When I think back about who it is that I met back in New York in 2008, someone who seemed so youthful and whose face was completely unlined, but had just a preternatural amount of energy.
And what's his comedic talent like? Is it any good?
It's fantastic. His comedic talent is remarkable. I've often said it's very Chaplin-esque. You can see in his face the vulnerability. You can see what's bothering him. You can see what's hurting him. You can see what's making him joyful without dialogue. And I think that's one of the things that has made him so successful throughout his entertainment career and, of course, now in his political career. Like a lot of stars, there's just a quality about them that allows you to see into their emotions and to relate to their thoughts. You can see it. You can feel it. And he has that. He's brilliant at physical comedy, brilliant at knowing how to use his body for laughs. Now, to be fair, so much of the Kvartal 95 sketch comedy that they would do on TV was what you might think of as mother-in-law comedy, kind of lowbrow. But in the movies, we specifically tried to introduce a Western sensibility. And since the Russian people would generally like to watch anything other than Russian entertainment content, the movies were very successful, probably because they had a Western sensibility, which is one of the great ironies of the Russian attitudes towards the West.
You directed Zelensky in 3 films, edited about 10. Stars can be a bit difficult, a bit tricky, a bit egocentric. Why do you like him, David?
I liked him, Vova, because he was a true partner. And I liked him because when he trusts you, and he makes a decision very early on as to whether or not he's going to trust you, he just gives you complete freedom, gives you all the room in the world to do what you're going to do. He would just say to me, David, I trust you. Do it.
There's one particular role that I guess we all look back on now and think that's kind of interesting that he did that. There was a hit TV show, Servant of the People, which saw him play a populist school teacher, everyday man, improbably elected to the country's highest office.
Absolutely. I mean, it's life imitating art, right? It was a massively popular television show. And of course, that got to become true.
But obviously, the films that he played in were big in Russia as well. Did anyone in Russia think of him as a villain or as a far-right nationalist in the way that Putin now portrays him back then?
I think it's very difficult to sell that story. Not that they're not trying to, but it's hard to believe that. So I don't think that was the case back then.
But how do you go from having, you know, if he's known in Russia as an actor, as a comedic actor or a dramatic actor, playing these roles, people love him. How easy or difficult is it for the Putin regime to suddenly shift what that image and that perception of him is?
It is a great question. I do think it was not a seamless transition.
Oleg, do you have a view as to how that has been conducted or achieved?
I guess in Kremlin, they celebrated Zelensky's victory as they celebrated Trump's victory in U.S. But with Trump, they got something they expected. With Zelensky, they didn't. But the first meeting in Paris, I remember that very well. But that was the first time Putin confronted Zelensky there. And all Russian propaganda machine was absolutely sure that so well experienced Putin, who is a master of political games, he would just simply cross Zelensky and Zelensky would be just a blood spot on that table. The KGB officer didn't know how to respond to the kind of comedian who got elected president much younger than him and who was already trolling him.
Are you saying, though, Ole, that actually in Moscow they were quite happy to see Zelensky elected because he didn't have much experience and they thought that could play into their hands?
Yeah, absolutely. They believe that he's, come on, comedian. They've been all saying that, oh, this guy, Putin would play him like a baby. And they clearly expected Zelensky to be easy target because, oh, what we discussed, his business in Moscow, his Jewish background, his Russian language, he was the kind of Russian-speaking citizen of Soviet Union, something very understandable for people in Kremlin. They could never expect Zelensky to take such a strong position for European integration and for NATO and for everything he did. So they didn't expect him to be capable of such things.
I don't see that as being very much of a leap, quite frankly, for Russia propagandists and Russian culture, because this goes back to what I feel like is a fundamental misunderstanding by Russia of who the Ukrainian people actually are. There has always been, for generations, a condescension by Russia to Ukraine and to Ukrainian people, seeing Ukrainians as cute little peasants. That condescension is very, very powerful. You can feel it. My wife was a script supervisor and producer on these films as well. And the Russian crew in Russia would make fun of her when she would speak Ukrainian. The attitude was very, oh, isn't that cute, little Ukrainian girl. And so it's not hard to take that attitude and to then transform that into Ukrainian villainy. Ukraine knew very well what it was to live underneath Soviet oppression. And it's no big mystery why they would want to turn more westward. And so to take Vova's popularity as an entertainer and then to simply just flip it upside down and to him being a menace, it's something that the Russian propagandists, the FSB, GRU, all of them are extremely good at. So it's not surprising at all that they were able to do that and do it so quickly and efficiently.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has conceded defeat to a comedian who has never served in
Volodymyr
parliament.
Zelensky is about to go from playing the president on a popular TV show in Ukraine to leading the country that is still in a war.
The landslide result for Volodymyr Zelensky, celebrated with a kiss for his wife and a dig at his opponent.
Had my wife heard all the things that were said about me in this campaign, then perhaps she would have never married me.
Are you ready to be president?
I don't know. The people will decide it in the evening. I'm ready.
Let's talk about the moment that he actually becomes president. April 2019, Ukraine goes to the polls. Zelensky's 41 years old. He's brimming with optimism and confidence that I think all of you have been describing. He's got this youthful sincerity about making peace with Russia as well. And he defeats his hardline opponent, Petro Poroshenko, in a 73% landslide victory. And he wins on this promise to end Ukraine's endemic corruption, end the war in Donbass with Russian-backed separatists, and to make Ukraine rich. David, when you watched the results come in, were you surprised that your friend was elected president of Ukraine?
I wasn't surprised that he was elected president. I think a lot of people that I knew in Ukraine, friends and family, were disappointed. I think a lot of people believed that Poroshenko was a better president for the country, but he clearly connected with people on a large level, even though the campaign didn't seem very like a very honorable campaign, you know, ducking debates. But it wasn't surprising. And I would love to know more from Olga and from Oleg what it was specifically about Zelensky that connected so powerfully with that bigger percentage of the country.
I think, David, that it might be just his literal absence of a political program with which he ran. He did not take any hardline positions on any of the divisive issues that traditionally were discussed in the Ukrainian society. And that was one thing that made him that, perhaps a little shaky, but made him that middle ground candidate that made him so appealing to a lot of people. And of course, his success of his show might have especially appealed to the younger audience that was really tired of the old Soviet ways to run the country, and that perhaps saw him as a representative of that new generation.
It's quite a feat to pull that off, being both a big personality, very well known, but also a small target politically, yeah. Sort of policy free.
Absolutely.
It's the phone call that sparked an impeachment inquiry. And now the US President Donald Trump has released...
There's also another kind of incredible twist here.
...in which he asks for a favour to help dig up dirt on former Vice President Joe Biden.
After US military aid was discussed, Mr. Trump replied, "That's fine. I would like you to do us a favour, though."
That President of Ukraine got from that call, and that was, "This is what I need. I know what you need." Like any mafia boss, the president didn't need to say, "That's a nice country you have. It'd be a shame if something happened to it."
Because just months into his presidency, Zelensky actually finds himself at the center of a huge American scandal. He becomes a supporting character, if you like, in the first impeachment of US President Donald Trump. And that focused on an infamous phone call in which Trump made it clear to Zelensky that any American military aid for Ukraine was conditional on Zelensky's support investigating the business dealings of Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Zelensky, though, said he would never have agreed to Donald Trump's deal.
Zelensky probably was rather naive to expect that he can use his charm over Trump, because Trump, he does not respond to charm. He sees only his goal and he ignores all any moral or any standards. So I think Zelensky, to some extent, was shocked when he was meeting Trump and discussing all the details. The story itself happened under the previous president. And Trump was hoping to use Zelensky, knowing that there is a big rivalry between newly elected President Zelensky and his predecessor. So what Trump was asking, actually, to correct some mistakes made by previous president. And Zelensky had not enough experience that time, but he managed, and his team managed to change communication and get dry out of water, as we used to say in Ukraine.
David, obviously Trump was then impeached. You watched all of this unfold from your home in California. What was it like seeing Zelensky get wrapped up in this huge American political drama?
If you remember the famous photograph of the Trump-Zelensky meeting of them sitting there in the chairs, and I see Vova sitting slumped in his chair wearing a suit, which you don't see anymore these days, with this look on his face that I could only, in my experience, interpret the thoughts in Vova's head to be, why am I sitting here with this idiot? Because I'm sure that Vova probably had the kind of hope that you're going to meet the American president and that this would be a momentous meeting that would be beneficial, you know, to everyone involved. But instead, Vova comes and sits down with this man who can think of nothing but his own self-aggrandizement. And so I can only imagine that Vova was deeply disappointed at how this was going, and to salvage and maintain a very, very critical strategic relationship with an important partner, the United States.
It's interesting. I'm looking at those images now, and even though you're describing the seriousness of the moment and the importance of the substance of the meeting, I'm really seeing that Chaplin-esque performer that you were describing earlier, David, the eyes, the body language, it is a bit theatrical.
It's theatrical, but it's also sincere. That's what makes it so powerful.
There had been accusations, though, against Zelensky that he was just playing president. He wasn't really being the president, that this was all a bit of an act.
I guess it also goes back to the narrative about his incompetence, right? His political incompetence. And so it's easy to fall into those tropes. And of course, he did make some decisions that kind of betrayed his inexperience in the political sphere. That is very true. So yes, it might have felt to many like he was playing the president.
Ole?
I wanted to emphasize one thing. Zelensky is the sixth president. I knew practically all Ukrainian presidents, and I knew that for them, foreign policy was something they didn't like. Well, they liked to travel abroad, but never invested personally in making friends, important allies with their counterparts. Zelensky is the first president who really cares and who honestly tries to befriend, if not to charm, to befriend heads of state. And he is working on that relationship. And that makes him great head of the state, unlike all previous Ukrainian presidents.
I think we should talk about Zelensky as a global figure, how consequential he is, because, you know, there are some that think he really is, if not the, one of the most consequential figures of our time. At the start of the war, for about 2 months, he was averaging about a speech a day. He was addressing venues like the South Korean Parliament, the World Bank, the Grammy Awards as well.
Tell the truth about the war on your social networks, on TV, support us in any way you can, any but not silence.
He then spoke to US Congress and he referenced Pearl Harbor and 9/11.
The president paused his address to play a video, switching between footage of Ukrainian cities in peacetime and graphic images of buildings being targeted, children crying, and bodies being thrown into graves.
I wish you to be the leader of the world. Being the leader of the world means to be the leader of peace. Thank you. Slava Ukraine.
The German parliament heard him invoke the history of the Holocaust and the Berlin Wall. And when he spoke to the UK House of Commons, he made an historic speech, quoting Winston Churchill.
We will not give up and we will not lose. We will fight till the end, at sea, in the air. We will fight in the forests, in the fields, on the shores, in the streets.
That's Volodymyr Zelensky speaking to the British Parliament. David, it obviously drew comparisons with Winston Churchill. Is it a fair comparison? Is he a modern-day Churchill in some regards?
I think there are two important points here to make. First, because Volva is such an effective communicator, he and his team know how to invoke these very specific emotional touchstones that are particular to the countries that he is addressing. Whether it's Pearl Harbor for the US, whether it's a Churchillian kind of language for the UK, or discussing matters, emotional matters around the Holocaust in Germany, he knows how to get that emotional reaction. And that's a key part of his ability to communicate and to marshal the kind of support he needs from the allies. The second point is that Volva is of a generation, he's young. So he's of a generation that has come of age in the internet era. And he's of a generation of Ukrainians that have come of age without any kind of sentimental attachment to the Soviet Union or to Russia. To these younger Ukrainians, because of their connectivity through the internet and everything else that the modern world gives them, TikTok, Instagram, they participate in the world, and in particular in the West, in a very direct way. There's no discussion as to whether or not they're going to be part of the Russian world or any other world. So when the war starts and they see their neighbor to the north doing everything they can to put a chain around their ankle and to bring them back into the Russian sphere of influence, it's something that they reject very powerfully and something that Volva would naturally reject very powerfully as well.
Ola, do you think that in digging in so firmly, Zelensky's also made it more difficult for Ukraine to ever strike any accord with Russia, to find a way out of this conflict? Has he made that more difficult?
Well, Russians made it practically impossible. If Zelensky would try to trade like territories for peace, he would be ousted in a few months. I am absolutely sure, and he knows that. Russia made it impossible for Ukrainians, and Ukrainians are not going to forgive what Russians did. That Putin is a genius in this sense. No Ukrainian leader would be allowed to deal with Putin personally and to try to re-engage or pretend that we turn over the page, because so many horrible things happen in Ukraine. And I know that Ukrainian people, Ukrainian voters, Ukrainian families will not forget.
Olga, throughout this conflict, though, Zelensky has been pushing for Ukraine to join the European Union and to join NATO. And obviously those questions remain unresolved and controversial. There are some that think that that will irritate Putin further, will make it more likely that the conflict continues. There are others that think that that's the only obvious pathway for Ukraine. But Zelensky's also been pushing allies for more weapons constantly, whether it's Australia or the United States or the United Kingdom. And actually, at the end of the last NATO summit, the UK Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, appeared to be getting annoyed at the end of that summit. He said that Ukraine had a habit of treating allies as if they were an Amazon warehouse with a list of demands. Olga, is he pushing it?
I mean, Ukraine signed the Budapest Memorandum, the UK signed the Budapest Memorandum, the US signed the Budapest Memorandum, so there had to be security assurances for Ukraine in the event if something like that were ever to happen. Well, I mean, Russia was also a signatory of the Budapest Memorandum, so I do not see Zelensky as pushing it.
So the Budapest Memorandum that Olga is referring to there was an agreement signed in 1994, and it gave security, independence, sovereignty assurances to its signatories. So the big players in it were the US, the UK and Russia. But as a result of this agreement, Kazakhstan, Ukraine and Belarus gave up their nuclear weapons and joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty as non-nuclear states.
I don't think that position was unjustified. Perhaps it could have been expressed more diplomatically, but I do think that given what's at stake, it is really important to support Ukraine right now with all means necessary.
You say that Zelensky pushes for EU and NATO, I would say no. Zelensky is being pushed by Ukrainians towards EU and NATO. He is heavyweight because of what Ukrainian people are doing.
Olev, how do you think history will remember Zelensky?
Well, you want me to be very frank?
Yeah.
I believe if he would be able to resist temptation and not to go for second term, he would be the greatest Ukrainian president.
Olga?
I would agree with this statement. And Zelensky...
So he might leave office while this war is still continuing?
Well, he will be... I mean, Ukraine is a democracy, right? It's not up to him whether he leaves office.
Sure, but you're saying that the smart thing for him to do is not run for a second term in the middle of all of this?
No. Ukrainian constitution says we cannot have elections if there is a war. So we are speaking about life after the victory.
Yes, and so that just would cement his legacy as a wartime leader.
David, next time you see your friend, do you think he'll be the same person?
I'm assuming that he'll be a different person. You can see certainly the physical evocation of who he was before the war and who he is now. Now he's much more filled out, much more of a bulldog kind of a presence. His face is rounder. How could something like this not transform someone? My only question is the transformation restricted to him, or is it part of a transformation of the entirety of the Ukrainian people's character, their perseverance, their dignity, their fight? And to the extent that Vova embodies all of that, he represents that very essential character of the Ukrainian people as well. So if Vova's transformed as a consequence of this horrific war, then so would the Ukrainian people. But they will take the best of who they are into the future, in the same way that Vova will probably take the best of who he is into the future.
Oleh Rybachuk, David Dodson, Olga Boychuk, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My mission was good. Bye.
This episode was produced by Linda Lopresti and Greg Muller. Technical producers were Bella Tropiano and Matthew Crawford. The executive producer is Maria Tickle. We love hearing your feedback, so please send us an email at tmtyl@abc.net.au. And of course, if you're on the ABC Listen app, you can give us a follow there. I'm Hamish McDonald. See you next time. He's the octogenarian leader who's up for election next year. So can he make it? And can he bring back consensus politics in a country that seems like it's on the brink? I'm talking, of course, about Joe Biden. That's on the next episode of Take Me to Your Leader.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.